You have a political cycle that's going to focus very heavily on how do we get back to a reasonable, sane, and rational domestic policy, which we've largely ignored for a long time now. We're going to look for things that work. There's a whole mood in Congress that's different. So there's a whole bunch of opportunities there. Having said that, I think it's way too early to really actually predict. But I did get into a conversation recently. You know, there are a lot of folks out there would say, which of the Republicans are going to win this? There's no Republican who's likely to win this. Rudy Giuliani can't win the conservative base, and without the conservative base, he can't win the primaries, and there's nobody. Right? So, which is a possibility. There's talk of both Chuck Hagel and Fred Thompson coming in as independents, which could really mess up. So all this stuff going on. Look at it on the other side, which is I really think that if you're really honest, if you watch what happened to Harold Ford in Tennessee last year, you really got to say, is this country really ready to elect a woman, an African American, or a Hispanic in the case of Bill Richardson? I mean, are we ready to do that? I think that's a really fundamental question. I hope so. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just hope so because I hope the people, whatever the outcome is, I hope the people of this country have gotten that far. But there's a part of me that looks at what happened, particularly in Tennessee last year, and I just think, boy, you know, let's not be Pollyannish and think that, you know, racism and sexism or genderism isn't more severe than we think it is. So
I would agree with a lot of what Mark says. I'm not going to predict a particular person, but I actually think the Democrat is going to win the election. I don't know who that's going to be. And in one sense, I'm
There's
not sure
all the
candidates are in front of us yet. I think, especially you mentioned the Republican candidates, that there's most of them have question marks over them, and there may be some other people who are out there who haven't even emerged yet. So it's kind of early to be predicting. But this is my sense right now. Of course, things completely change. Is that the Democrats will win the White House in the next election, probably not by very much, but we'll see. And Mark is exactly right on that. The leading Democratic candidates do have familiarity with micro enterprise, and this happens, we'll be in infinitely better position than we've ever been before. And I look forward to that day.
Indeed.
I'm going to take a little bit of time here, and I'll try and be somewhat succinct, but this is an interesting opportunity for me personally because I have all kinds of thoughts, but I'm going to not say them directly. mainly this is rare for me because mm-hmm. normally I put it out there, mm-hmm. but I didn't get a chance to talk about it, and now's a good time. I'm organizing right now with a lot of colleagues a thing called the Primary Project in New Hampshire. We as a sector cannot sit on the sidelines with our fingers crossed that the right thing happens. We have to be directly involved from now on. See what happens? I thought I went off for a second. What we're doing is basically we have already invited the nonprofits of New Hampshire, organized by the New Hampshire Center of Nonprofits, their state association. We've sent out invitations to all the declared candidates to come to forums in which the nonprofits of New Hampshire, acting on behalf of all nonprofits, will ask the candidates three very simple questions. What's your direct experience with a nonprofit organization? How would you strengthen the sector to be a partner in your vision for America? And again, how would you partner with us? We're setting the stage by saying, again, and by sending out in advance with all these invitations, a basic one-pager that says, look, whoever wins the next election and serves for 4 or 8 years is going to have to deal with the beginning of 80 million people getting old in America. And that is a huge, huge issue in which we really don't have a plan. And at the same time, we're going to be dealing with a very, very aggressive global economy, in which we're going to probably see a significant amount of white-collar jobs leave in America. The nonprofit sector in this country represents 10% of the workforce. You know, we are 10% of the economy. Which one of you is smart enough to recognize that we're not charity, that we're the best partner you could possibly have? Mm-hmm. That's where we're going. So from now on, part of the temporary restraints that nonprofits have as far as our 501c and election leering is that we have to be hyper vague. We can't say we want to vote for this person or show any sort of bias. So as the leader of this is the first opportunity I've had to basically say I'm not going to say anything. But I will say that in the next issue of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'll have an editorial printed that says, in effect, The era in which nonprofits accept this muzzled role must end. I got to be honest with you, I didn't know this until I just went out and did just literally one day's worth of research. But you know what I found out? And what I found is how very few people know this. But we were completely, along with foundations able and churches, able to participate in the political process until 1954, mm-hmm. when Lyndon Johnson, who was being basically hounded by some churches in Texas over his election process, in the middle of the night, without any hearing, with no testimony, inserted language that made it, hence heretofore, illegal for us to be involved politically. So to silence a few of his enemies, he silenced us all. And we've stayed there ever since. And that era's got to end. Right now, we get about a little over $200 billion every year in donations. Corporate America gets $210 billion in, I don't want to use the word corporate welfare, because that's a derogatory term, but the point is they get incentives over $200 billion, and they can use that money to directly contribute to political campaigns. They can directly influence legislation, yet we're supposed to sit quietly and accept we're bullied into silence. And I think we have to collectively step forward. Because, like, if you look at any independence movement, it reached a point where their leadership said, there's not enough jail cells for all of us. They can't deal with it economically. And the reality is, brothers and sisters, you know, there comes a point when we have to stand up and say, we triple dog dare you to shut us down. Take away our 501s. You can't live without us. And we're not going to be quiet any longer.
Yay.
So that's it for today.
That's it for today?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Well, at least for that.
You have to see what kind of questions I ask you later. Did you want to say something?
Yes, I did. I agree with you that we need to be neutral. Well, we have been neutral, and credit unions, the industry I represent, are neutral. But to answer your question directly, just if I had to make a guess, and it's not a prediction, just a guess, of the candidates that we know, and it could be somebody else, but if it's not, it would probably be Giuliani, because...
Wow.
The U.S. is still afraid about 9/11 and security, mm-hmm. and he's the strongest one out. And I'm not a pro Giuliani fan, but I'm just
giving your prediction.
Give my prediction.
Caitlin, did you want to make a prediction?
I don't want to predict certainly the top candidate as for president. But when you look at the field of Democrats, which I think most panelists and most people are feeling that that's more likely than a Republican. To happen in 08. What's exciting to me, and I don't know as much about the Republican side, is that there are so many candidates with diverse backgrounds and interests, and a lot of them are micro-friendly, that even if they don't end up being elected to president, they'll be Secretary of the State and they'll be State Department, and that's a really exciting thing for our field to have strong candidates, potentially presidential candidates, filling some of those top positions.
Thank you, Caitlin.
What Robert was saying, because I think that the underlying message of that, which is just we're not going to take it anymore,
right?
I mean, is really something, maybe it comes to the nonprofit culture, maybe it becomes of the kind of work, I mean, I see it in our field, which is micro and other things, where people feel like, no, what we're doing is we're doing transactions, or we're helping this person here, right? And that ability to look, I appreciate what you said, because that ability to look up and say, you know, we need to move upstream in this debate, mm-hmm. right? We need to be where the decisions are being made in some way is a great message. And I don't think any of us should be afraid to do that. There are a lot of ways to do it while we're fixing the system you're going to fix. So it's great.
You know, this is one of my favorite subjects. And just to do a little historic context, though, to be young in America now, I mean, the changes that are coming, if it's not this election, it's the next. But for microfinance, I mean, if I may, you know, 100 years ago, white men obviously ruled. And if you were a woman or you were a color, you did what white men told you to do. And about halfway through the century, it started to break. In fact, right after World War II, it started to break. But if you came into power, and many people, they hid their accents. They changed their name to conform, because we all wanted to fit into a certain model of success. This is the first time, literally, almost in the history of the planet, in which people who come from backgrounds are standing up and saying, you know, my mother was a single mother, and we had food stamps. And God damn it, she was a great mother and a great woman, and I'm proud of my heritage. And now that I'm in power, I'm going to do something about it. People are owning their heritage now as they never have before. So this is going to be great for microfinance, because you're going to see people who come into power now who are really going to use that power as it's never been used before in history. So, again, I think it's a glorious time. And while it might not manifest itself in this immediate election, and there are a lot of challenges facing America, there's amazing things coming.
Here's one question, if I could pose it to...
And pardon my goddamn pardon.
Folks here, since we're talking about elections and power, what about some of our folks running for office? What about some of the leadership of the local level? I don't mean for president right now, but maybe eventually, as you build it up, but have running for the state legislature, running for the mayor, the city council, for other offices like that.
Totally agree. There's already, you know, interesting enough, in the House and Senate, there are a lot of people who've run nonprofits already. But again, I don't think we've taken full advantage of that. So, but you're right, a lot of things are coming that way.
Would anyone else from the audience like to join the panel? Okay, I'll make my prediction. I predict, no matter what the outcome, we are going to be in a better position than we have been in a long time. And I also predict that the winner will be from the state of Illinois. Okay. Mark, you're here. You traveled a long way. Are there questions you'd like to pose to our colleagues here?
I wasn't able to come to more of the conference. I had a board meeting. I was doing other things. So I came out here, and I'm curious in the sort of the tenor of discussion. It's related to the question I asked you, which is sort of what's standing in our way, mm-hmm. right? What is it that we need to fix if we're really going to achieve the promise of microenterprise or the promise of community development or the promise of what we call opportunity finance? Or, you know, what are those things? What are the big boulders we've got to get out of the road?
At public perception.
Mm-hmm. Public perception.
Yeah, I think marketing. I think that's been a common theme throughout the whole week, is we really have to invest and be very, I think, quite frankly, very aware of our own language. I must admit, I constantly pinch myself. It's like the word homeless drives me nuts. I mean, homeless is a fuzzy word that keeps us from dialogue about housing, wage, prison, domestic violence, mental health. They're each really huge subjects that aren't just going to magically vanish unless we have a conversation. So, but the language, when we use words like needy, inner city, are we elevating the dialogue or are we perpetuating stereotypes? And we need to recognize the number one friend and partner we're going to get is Joe and Jane Q. Public that are walking down the street out there looking for what we're selling. They really are. If I may, and I apologize, I tend to go on, but I'll just do this really quick. The future isn't going to be people writing checks at the end of the year to charity anymore. There's a younger generation coming up that's not going to have extra money. And even if they did, we've raised a generation. You know, 90% of every single university's freshman class in every single town you live in, 90% of them have done community service. Their time is their philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And our entire sector is built on saying, yeah, that's great, but can we have some of your money too? And it's not going to be there. But what we're doing is we're saying there's a new kind of philanthropy, and it's how you spend your money every day. And it's the only long-term sustainable philanthropy there is. So we have to start really talking to people about what we do, not in the context of good, bad, right, or wrong, but smart, dumb. And what we do is really, really smart. And again, it's capitalism. It is capitalism 2.0. You know, it's the idea that you can get a service and you can do social good at the same time. Who doesn't like this? But we need to become really tireless advocates of what we do. I mean, you should not wake up any single day and not think, how can I spread the word about what we're doing?
Literally. Well, I'd like to add to answer Mark's question in this way. Last week, we were at the CDFI Institute. We got $30 million the year before, and they said that if we hadn't have gone there, Senator Reid, Democrat from Rhode Island, said if we hadn't have walked the hill, we would have gotten no money. It would have been folded over into a general program. We have to get away from the idea that government is a burden on people to it's a help. It's extremely necessary. And we have to walk the hill a lot more and conscientizar, make people aware that we're working together and take a lot. The money that's going to the wars is an incredible waste. Mm-hmm. You might be pro-war, against war, but it's an incredible amount of money as compared to $30 million. We're asking for 60. So I think that's what we need to do.
I'd like to jump in here. Thank you. Imagine what we could have done with all the money that we spent on the war if we'd used that for positive purposes. We could have solved so many human needs. But that's my personal experience.
Let me jump into that, because I don't disagree. There's no question this industry, and from my perspective, the broader sort of industry, could use capital, much more capital than is available, and make good use of it. But what you were referring to that Senator Reid talked a little bit about was a few years ago, some of you remember, the White House came out with a proposal called SACI. They called it Strengthening America's Communities Initiative, although inside the White House it was known as Strangling America's Communities Initiative, which is true.
Yeah.
And the idea was they were going to fold every community development program in the federal government into one block grant program. It was going to run through the states, which, you know, that's a proven model, right? It was going to run through the states and was going to run out of the Department of Commerce. And so it was really just an effort to gut anything you might think of as community development in the government. And I think, my reaction to that and what I said publicly was that it was popcorn policy because it was a lot of hot air surrounding a kernel of truth, right? And we were able to beat it because it was a lot of hot air and the White House didn't think about it very much. But there's a kernel of truth to that. And I want to say it here. You invited me to be provocative. Because we need to be honest about the fact that not all community development programs work, not all CDFIs are good, not all microenterprise organizations are great. You know, you got to be honest about that and deal with that, right? You got to deal with, if it's not working, how do you fix it? Doesn't mean you throw it away. It's not a bad idea. But I think that there was an opportunity, actually, in that SACI proposal to have an honest discussion about what works and what doesn't work and what's right for the last generation, what's right for the current generation, what's right for the next generation. And I'm not sure we're having that conversation. I think we owe it to ourselves and, more important, to the people we serve to figure out if we're going to get a dollar from the federal government, how are we going to make sure we're making the best damn use of it we can? Because I don't think we hold ourselves to high enough standards in our industry.
I'd like to have a conversation on that, too. There's a lot of different programs that are scattered all around in different agencies. Some have strengths, some have weaknesses. It'd be nice to have a conversation. What does the industry need? How can we best meet the needs of the industry through a rational program so the public sector dollars go into the right places and the people should be held accountable? But the way Congress creates laws and funds programs is here, and then they look at it again and create something over here and here and here. And it would be fantastic to have that program have some rational sense of things. It's hard to do that when the people on the other side don't want you to, any of the programs to exist. So I think when the time comes, that's an important idea to keep, so that when the time comes, we can go forward with that. It could be done much better than it is.
Thanks, Kevin.
Can I respond or no?
Fast.
I think that's right, but I think the time is now. I mean, it was not a safe time then to have that conversation because there was too much risk. The time is now. My board just approved a process for doing some of that stuff. We need to be honest. We need to think hard, and we need to think forward, not just till next year or till the elections or anything. We need to think forward 5 and 10 and 15 years to figure out what's going to be right then. So.
Agree. Thank you.
As we're thinking years out, I got to be honest with you, we got to really get serious about this because we've got... We've got serious, this war, among many other things, this is going to create deficits years out.
Yep.
And the reality is 80 million people, 25% of every state's budget is already Medicaid, Medicare, and there's 80 million people getting old. So my caution to you, as well as when you go back home, you know, if you're a job trainer, you got to become an employer. If you provide shelter, you got to build housing. You know, the era of us being service providers is really coming to an end. And I think that the reality is we're going to have to start to create jobs. No one's going to come into your town and say, I'll hire all the felons. You know, I'll build housing for the poor. We're going to have to do that ourselves.
This is a few points back, but I just wanted to respond briefly to the issue that you touched on. And that is that as we look at the framing and the vocabulary around our industry, and also the fact that we are a growing, you know, new industry made of humans, and we're learning and trying by trial and error, figuring things out. I think that bringing us to the level of legitimacy where we can recognize that corporations and government and other entities that have had similar, they have similar issues, they have the scale issues, they have the effectiveness issues, the cost issues, and also the moral issues that we've seen very clearly. As a human, as an organization that works with business and heart jointly, recognizing that, yes, we have those issues, but so do all these other organizations that have, or industries that have legitimacy, and framing ourselves, putting ourselves to that level so that we can really you know, have people recognize the validity of what we do. I think that there's the opportunity in that to turn that back right around on the dime.
Well, and I think we have, I actually think we have that. I mean, I think we have that. I think we're afraid to take it, but I think we have that. And it's a little bit your point. It's, you know, having Dr. Yunus win the Nobel Prize is a legitimizing thing. Last year at our conference, we had Chairman of the Federal Reserve, you know, come and speak, and he's spoken at some of John Taylor's conference. I mean, Alan Greenspan had. I mean, that stuff, it's there. Other people see us in a... Other people see us in a more legitimate view than we see ourselves.
I agree.
My name is
Lisa.
Boy, is that loud. And I think what I'd like to share is a little bit of perspective from a policy background. Mm-hmm. I used to work with Harry Reid on his staff when he was in the House. And I learned about the political process, and I understood how incredible we have checks and balances and how dedicated these policymakers were. But it wasn't until I actually started volunteering with Results, which is a hunger lobby, that I learned the incredible power that I have as just an individual and my ability to affect policy change in collaboration with others. So Results, we get, you know, get together once a month, 300 of us around the world, and we get a laser talk, we practice it, and then we go sit down with our policymaker, and we go sit down with our editorial board member, and then we affect policy and media perception. And I predict that we will indeed get where we want to go together, further, faster, if we look at and attend to and base our decisions on our assets, like we do in microenterprise, but also our assets in citizenship. When we graduate our folks, we help them understand the political process. They come and testify with us at the city council. They come and testify at the hearings. They learn not only how to be policy change advocates for our issue, but for their own. So if we can partner our strategies to not only include skills in building confidence and financial literacy, but also citizenship literacy, we will go far.
Thank you. I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I have the time cops breathing down on me. So I'd like to thank all of those, especially the members of the audience that joined the panel, and Mark and Robert and Brian and Caitlin. And thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.